Case number 20-3954, United States of America versus Brandon McKinney. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Grostick for the appellant.
Thank you, Christian Grostick, on behalf of Brandon McKinney. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
And may it please the court, this appeal is about three conclusions that the district court made in its order denying Mr. McKinney's motion to reduce his sentence. The first is that the district court held that an over seven years guidelines correction cannot be part of the extraordinary and compelling reasons necessary to reduce a sentence under Section 35A2C1A. Now, that first holding was an error of law. The statutes say only one thing cannot be an extraordinary and compelling reason, and that's rehabilitation alone. That's in 18 U.S.C. Section 994T. Nothing in the text gives courts the ability to read some additional categorical limitation into what can be extraordinary and compelling reasons.
But why is that? I mean, why can't one take the view that change to the guidelines, I mean, there's a whole process for allowing change to the guidelines to be retroactive. So we have that whole thing. We have this practice since 1984 of how the Bureau of Prisons dealt with this. And best I can tell, they didn't think changes to the guideline counted as extraordinary. So I guess as a matter of statutory interpretation, I hear you that they rule out one thing, and that does have an implication. Maybe they meant not to rule out anything else, but I don't know. It seems to me a fairly reasonable thing to say that guidelines changes happen quite often, and that's the opposite of extraordinary.
I take the court's point, and I would add, I think I started with the negative implication, right, is that one thing Congress has ruled out. The next thing I would say, though, is that there's an affirmative reason why this would constitute an extraordinary and compelling reason. And it's that Mr. McKinney, when he was sentenced, was told his guidelines range was 151 to 181 months, 12 and a half to 15 and a half years. And none of his conduct has changed. None of his offense conduct, none of his criminal history has changed. But today he would be told, now your guidelines range is 60 to 71 months, 5 to 6 years. The common understanding of what an extraordinary and compelling reason is, this fits. This is, the courts has stepped in the meantime and said, we've taken another look at this provision, and this is what it means, and this is what it has meant all along.
Out of curiosity, I'm sorry I don't know the answer to this. So we have changes to guidelines by the commission, and then they have their shot at retroactivity. Do they have equal authority? So the Sixth Circuit, you know, does something new with offender guidelines. Can the commission step in and say, you know, we noticed that a bunch of circuits have reconsidered this. This is quite unfair to quite a few defendants. We think these new interpretations can be retroactive. Is that authority they have or not have?
I believe it is. Talking outside my immediate knowledge also, but I would say that obviously the Sentencing Commission can adopt an amendment to the guidelines, right? Where they could adopt.
Well, I'm imagining a world where they don't need to change the amendment. It's just a function of, because we have two moving parts. We're getting new guidelines all the time and then new interpretations of the same guideline. And
I don't believe the Sentencing Commission has the authority to say that these court decisions now apply retroactively. I do believe the commission could step in and say, we adopt the interpretation the court has given now, and that new amendment where we've adopted that applies retroactively. It may be a distinction without a difference in if they actually did that, right?
But if you're right about this approach, if defendants have had authority after 2010 in the Fair Sentencing Act, they could have for the next 8 years have sought compassionate release instead of waiting for the First Step Act, right? I mean, I take it that's your view. We don't need First Step Acts anymore under this view.
I think the courts are empowered to do that, yes, in individual cases. Now, and I think the McCoy case out of the Fourth Circuit has a good discussion of this, fairly extensive, where they talk about how it is consistent in the court's view that Congress could adopt some things that apply retroactively, like they did in the First Step Act with the Fair Sentencing Act, categorically across the board. Every inmate gets to file these things. Then they can also provide what they call the safety valve provision, where without being entitled to relief in every case, an individual can still say, in my particular case, these particular changes, perhaps, and in this case it's true, combined with other circumstances, this combination of things is extraordinary and compelling in my individual case. And so in this individual case, for example, we would contend that the significant reduction, I mean, over 7.5 years in his guidelines range, combined with his post-sentencing conduct, rehabilitation alone can't be considered, but rehabilitation in combination with other factors can be. And also the health risks and increased severity of his sentence that he's undergone over the past year due to the pandemic, that those would comprise extraordinary and compelling reasons together. So when the court stepped in and said, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, sorry.
When the court stepped in and said this cannot be as a matter of law, we believe the court erred, again, for those, the reason that it's inconsistent with the text, it's inconsistent with the common understanding.
The thing I'm just struggling with is, the word extraordinary doesn't come to mind when I think of changes to the guidelines or changes to our interpretations. I mean, if you'll forgive me and be a little too indulgent, that's all it seems like I do. I feel like that's all I've done for 18 years is play with new guideline changes. And as my clerks will attest, I get a little frustrated with it. I would find it extraordinary if in the next 2 years there was no change. Like that would be extraordinary. No new guidelines, no new court decisions interpreting them. So I'm just struggling with the word. Like on the reality, it's not extraordinary at all. It happens almost every month.
I see the point, and I think across the board saying every guidelines case and every guidelines change or every guidelines interpretation change is an extraordinary circumstance would also be an error of law. But a significant change over 7 years where the court has stepped in and said this was wrong from the beginning, and he's now left to serve a 12.5-year sentence simply because of the timing. If the court had stepped in before he was sentenced, he'd be facing a 60 to 71 month range. If he had committed
a sentence later. How does this interact with First Step Act? Should a person who has they're entitled to bring a First Step Act claim, they benefit because they were sentenced under crack cocaine, they got the bad increase, but they also have a bunch of other changes they want to use. The way this should work going forward is the savvy defendant brings both at the same time. So you bring First Step Act, say reduce, account for that, do the as if. And by the way, I've got a compassionate release thing I'd like you to consider too. And you can use it on, you can consider it in both ways, but it would allow you to consider all these changes. Is that what the world should look like in the future?
That's a difficult question for me to answer in the abstract, I think. I think when Congress made the Fair Sentencing Act retroactive in the First Step Act, it gave a whole category of prisoners the ability to walk in and say, you court are empowered to resentence me as if this was in place at the time, and I want that now. And compassionate release, which as the Second Circuit said, is a bit of a misnomer. The statute talks about reducing sentences, but compassionate release is about my individual circumstances in this individual case. But yes, it could include statutory or guidelines changes that make my case unusual. And again, to go back to your previous question, Judge Sutton, I would say perhaps a small guidelines change is not an extraordinary and compelling circumstance. And I think we can trust district courts to recognize that in most cases. But to categorically say that no change in the guidelines, even 7 years of this man's life, cannot be considered extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
What's the point of 2255 anymore?
Well, 2255 is an automatic entitlement. A sentence or a conviction is vacated and someone's resentenced automatically. 2255 doesn't provide relief, obviously, for guidelines corrections. But the fact that relief isn't available under that statute isn't a reason to read in that it's also not available under another statute. And again, I think McCoy and Brooker out of the Second Circuit speak to this. McCoy's language about a safety valve specifically discusses that in individual cases, relief may not be available under 2255 or under some other retroactivity provision, but that compassionate, this statute, 3582, stands there ready in individual circumstances to correct what, or not necessarily to correct, but to provide another avenue for relief for individual defendants in their circumstances.
What are you asking to do? You want us to vacate the district court to now at least consider the application of compassionate relief to your circumstances?
I apologize, Judge Gilman. I wasn't able to hear your question.
You're breaking, Ron. You're breaking up. I couldn't hear the question either.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm not speaking out loud.
You're much. Yes. Do like what you're doing now. Do that.
Right. What relief are you asking for? You want us to vacate and remand?
Yes. That's correct. We would like the court to vacate and remand, and instruct. Simply instruct the court that this is not categorically excluded. And I do that in full recognition that the district court might come back and say, well, in this individual case, I don't find it's extraordinary and compelling. And we would then obviously review the court's decision and its reasoning for that and decide how to proceed from there. But we would ask the court, yes, to vacate and remand, to give guidance to the lower courts that there is not a categorical exclusion for this type of change, and also to instruct the lower courts that when they do the 3553A analysis that's part of 3582, they have to consider the current guidelines in that analysis, which I don't believe is actually in dispute. The government didn't dispute that.
Can I ask you this question? If we follow your approach, they're not categorically banned. They can consider changes in the law, and can they go below the changes in the law?
Right, and that's a very interesting question.
You're not allowed to say they're interesting questions when they hurt. You have to answer the interesting questions.
No, I understand. I was going to say we've actually discussed that internally, right?
I've been discussing it with some other cases, right? Here. What's the answer? Help me out.
I'm not sure. My position would be that the history, the text, and actually the history going back all the way to the Comprehensive Crime Control Act says that yes, in individual cases, they can go below even what might be a mandatory sentence originally.
Okay, I love sentencing. I love seeing you argue. I love my job. But I mean, how many times do we have to do these things over? I mean, I want fairness, but there's a practical side to this. And it's not, when I say us, that's really a very cheap point. We're not the ones, this is not that hard for us. It's very hard for district court judges to do this 2 to 3 times with every defendant.
It is. And I believe, as the practical matter right now goes, I would say that we're in this in-between time where the old Sentencing Commission guidance is no longer applicable. Hopefully there will be again soon, and that will provide more of a specific criteria about what district courts use. But in this in-between time, I would submit that it's up to district courts, with the guidance of the Court of Appeals, obviously, though, to develop these standards for how to apply this this language. But the language is extraordinary and compelling reasons, and the only categorical exclusion is rehabilitation alone. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Lutzko?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Rebecca Lutzko for the United States. Your Honors, the district court appropriately exercised its discretion in refusing to release Mr. McKinney 3.5 years into a 12 and a half year sentence, and therefore this court should affirm. There are 4 points that I plan to address. The first of which is I would point out that the district court's opinion here was issued on August 27th of 2020. As you're well aware, there's been significant opinions modifying the legal landscape. And so much of what the government wrote, even in its brief, and defendants wrote in his, have been decided. And certainly the landscape that the district court was operating in was not as clear as it is today. Point number two, however, is that the district court's decision.
Can I just stop you there on point one? This is somewhat consistent with Judge Gilman's question. You know, we could decide the big issues and lay down a bunch of markers, and that has the benefit of guidance for everybody else. But there is obviously a shorter path. You just acknowledged a lot has changed. It's not that unusual. U.S. Supreme Court does this all the time, to send a case back, particularly one with some lurking difficult issues, back to the district court judge and let them decide what they want to do in light of the recent Sixth Circuit decisions. What's wrong with that path here?
I don't think it's necessary here, and that I think that the guidance from this court outweighs doing that in this case, because in particular here, the district court, and you'll note at note three of its opinion on page ID 2756, specifically acknowledges the discretion that it had. And so while the court does talk about 1B1.13 and certainly does rely on it, it does not rely on it exclusively, and instead relies on its ability and analyzes this case through other reasons that it deems appropriate. So it doesn't feel itself bound, and therefore this is not the kind of situation where a court didn't recognize its authority. And in those situations, certainly it is appropriate to send it back, but that's not what we have here.
You know, that's why I don't like footnotes. I mean, the whole opinion is they have no discretion, and then maybe we do.
I want to second Judge Gilman's point that we would vacate and remand solely to elevate the point raised in a footnote into text. That strikes me as a very good rule.
Your Honors, I actually agree with you both and try very hard to keep footnotes out of my briefs, in particular because, Judge Sutton, I remember you saying that it is difficult for you to read them on your iPads. And so I agree. I would not have put that in a footnote, but nonetheless, the district court here did acknowledge that discretion. And therefore, I do think it is important for the court to move forward in this. And in particular, because not only did the court acknowledge its discretion, but it's essentially was the functional equivalent of what this court handed down, or it applied the functional equivalent of what this court announced in the Jones opinion and then in the Elias opinion. So,
I don't think the footnote even solves the problem, though. What the footnote said is, look, it isn't necessarily bound by the Bureau of Prisons standard, you know, the policy statement, but that's different from whether it could categorically not be able to consider the change of sentence of what it would be. That is not part of necessarily the policy statements.
You're right, Your Honor. And actually, I think there are two different things that are going on here. So I guess the first thing, and the reason I brought up the footnote, was because this is not an opinion where the district court is saying it's bound by the policy. The broader issue, and the issue that my opposing counsel spent most time on here, goes to whether the court can or cannot, as a matter of law, essentially find that changes in the guidelines or changes in sentencing law, whether that's by statute or guideline or this court's opinion, is a permissible, extraordinary and compelling reason. And it's the government's position it's not, that those are categorically excluded.
Just to be clear, that it never is. Legal changes is the government's position is legal changes never count as extraordinary and compelling.
Yes.
No matter, like, you know, 50-year change.
Yes, Your Honor, because the reason that is, I mean, it's multifold, but certainly there are other statutory provisions and other methods by which those are addressed. So for instance, Congress, when it makes a 50-year change or changes, for instance, the 924C laws, in the First Step Act, they determined that those were not retroactive. And so if a district court can say, well, you know what, I disagree with that, and I think it should be retroactive, and do an end run around Congress, then you're setting up a separation of powers issue, a very significant one. Other ways to address those type of...
Does that make your view turn on just a fact-law dichotomy, that compassionate release is solely a fact issue? He's aging. He is... he's got cancer. His family now needs him because his wife died.
Yes. Yes. It's a very, as the district court here recognizes,
is there any appellate authority that draws that line and says this law only applies to fact changes, not law changes?
Not that I'm aware of off the top of my head, Your Honor. I would note that in our Alam decision, which the district court did cite, and by our, I mean your Alam decision, certainly you were focusing on the fact that it is things such as aging, things such as terminal illness. I would further note that actually in the Senate report from the 1984 Sentencing Reform Act that my opposing counsel cites when they say that Congress was concerned with correcting unusually long sentences, that quote is actually out of context. And if you look at that specifically at pages 55 to 56 of the Senate report, as well as page 121, you'll see that Congress is very clear that they're talking about three things. They're talking about terminal illnesses. They're talking about defendants who have been in jail for 30 years after essentially having a three strikes and you're out kind of situation, and they've reached a significant age where they should no longer, we should grant some compassion. And third, to changes to the sentencing guidelines that the Sentencing Commission makes retroactive. And so that really is, I would say, was certainly Congress's expressed intent when they passed and inserted this extraordinary and compelling reason limited modification to sentences into the law.
Which report are you referring to?
I'm referring to the Senate report.
Legislative history. So
yes, it is legislative history. You're correct. And that 225.
You know, isn't the Fourth Circuit's McCoy case against your position?
It is, Your Honor. And it is, and while I would certainly acknowledge that the language used in Elias and Jones was broad and could encompass that, neither of those cases actually had that presented to them nor held that. And McCoy, to my knowledge, is the only circuit that has taken such an extreme position and found that the changes in the law can constitute extraordinary and compelling reasons. Brooker, also, their language in the Second Circuit would allow for it, but they remanded that case, so I don't believe it was ultimately decided.
We would be setting up a circuit split if we agree with your position.
Yes, and the department does like to avoid those. but nonetheless, I think it's the right position. And it's the right position for several reasons.
Am I right? You've not won yet in a court of appeals?
Not to my knowledge. The only opinion really addressing it in the court of appeals is McCoy. But I would say that, Your Honors, when you're considering this issue, you've got to remember that extraordinary and compelling has its own independent statutory teeth, right? It's got to be extraordinary. It's got to be compelling. And Judge Sutton, I believe you hit that nail right on the head when you said that, you know, there's nothing extraordinary about sentencing changes, or whether it's an interpretation by this court or a change by the Sentencing Commission or a change by Congress. Those, in fact, are rather ordinary.
How often would it be that there'd be a 7.5-year discrepancy?
Your Honor, I think certainly that those kind of things happen when the the mandatory minimums were changed by Congress for various drug laws. There were very significant differences when you change the levels. And ultimately, Congress is the one that made that decision, as is their prerogative, and that when ultimately in the First Step Act, they made it retroactive. And so it is, you know, Congress sets the sentencing policy and the courts apply it. But I don't believe that that change I apologize.
Well, just forgive me for not knowing the answer to this. The 7.5 year change here is an advisory change, not a binding change, right?
Not only is it an advisory change, but the other thing that if we're going to go back and look at that, the government in this case forewent filing an 851 enhancement, which also would have changed the mix of, you know, what was going on here. But yes, of course, it is an advisory change, other than to the extent that there were, I believe, a 60-year mandatory minimum sentence that controlled here.
60 months.
I apologize. Did I say yes? Yes, 60 months. That's what I meant. More broadly, I would say that if we allow sentencing disagreements with sentencing policy or non-retroactive sentencing changes to nonetheless constitute extraordinary and compelling reasons, we're in effect reinstituting the parole power that Congress abolished as part of the Sentencing Reform Act when it enacted 3582.
The Parole Act often dealt with rehabilitation questions primarily, didn't it?
The Sentencing Reform Act, was that your question?
No, you're talking about reinstituting parole.
Yes. And they got rid of the parole board. In fact, the quote that opposing counsel cites when they talk about the unusually long sentences, that's directly in a discussion regarding the parole board. And the primary impetus behind
counsel, I don't think you heard Judge Gilman's question. Oh. He was making the point that parole usually turned on rehabilitation.
Oh.
Rehabilitation is out the window. So it's funny for the government to say this will reinstate parole. I'm with him. I think that's an exaggeration. I mean, it's giving a lot of authority to district court judges, but parole was usually tied to rehabilitation, and we now know that's not part of the equation.
Well, that is true, and Congress does make very clear that that's one of the primary points of the Sentencing Reform Act, in addition to the idea of uniformity in sentencing. And so yes, Your Honor, but I would further point out that, you know, with respect to sentencing guideline issues, the Sentencing Commission has been designated by Congress to set those guidelines. And it's the commission that determines when a guideline change, for instance, is retroactive. And that's, in fact, what 3582C2 addresses. And so if courts can modify, say the Sentencing Commission says, I'm changing the guideline, and it's not retroactive. But if a court can say, well, I disagree, and can use 3582C1A1 as a reason to do what the Sentencing Commission says in 3582C2, you cannot, then you're setting up a conflict, or not even a conflict, I mean, it's diametrically opposed. So that is yet another, when you look at the overall structure of how Congress set up this very limited authority to modify a sentence. It's the very first line in 3582C, and they want to give judges the opportunity to do that only in very unusual circumstances.
What's your view of, in getting a compassionate release motion, is a district court allowed to think of the 355-3A factors?
Yes. And certainly, okay, Your Honor,
next question, they're allowed to consider them. Future dangerousness is a classic example of something you'd consider. Recidivism, career offender, is the kind of thing that makes someone look dangerous. But if the rules on career offender have changed, and you're told to consider 355-3A, shouldn't you consider today's future dangerousness under the current career guidelines as opposed to yesterday's?
So, Your Honor, I would say they factor in, but they don't factor in at the extraordinary and compelling place.
Switch turns on, and if it turns on, then you can consider it.
Correct, Your Honor. And you can consider it, the changes, for instance, in the vein of looking at, well, how long has this defendant served? How much time does this defendant have left to serve? Do the guidelines today or the sentences today that defendant would give reflect something or say something about the seriousness of this offense and or what kind of deterrence this particular defendant needs?
This is helpful, but let's just say you get a compassionate release motion. The fella has a bad disease. He's aging and his family needs him. So now the switch is on.
Yes.
And now you're considering to release him immediately. That's option A, or to release him in a couple of years and shave 5 years off his sentence.
Yes.
You don't want to release him immediately. So you're debating whether to shave 5 years off. At that point, can you consider that the meaning of the career offender guidelines has changed? That's okay at that point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Now, I would say, and just to address one of the points raised in the defendant's brief here, is that
is this the same? The, is this an answer to the same question that
I think so, but I will defer.
Well, if it's a direct response to his question, go ahead and say what you want to say. If this is starting a new point, your time's up.
Okay. So what I wanted to say was that the guideline calculation that applies is what applied at the time of sentencing, but those factors, nonetheless, the current guideline calculation would go into the 3553A factors. So as my time is up, I will thank all of your honors and ask that you affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Krostick, your rebuttal. Krostick.
Thank you. I will try to say that and fulfill this promise to make one point. Many of the government's arguments are about address whether sentencing changes categorically are extraordinary and compelling reasons. That is not our contention. We're saying the district court erred by holding that they cannot be, that they categorically aren't. We are not saying that every change.
But counsel, I mean, it's so puzzling to me to think Congress knows how to make changes retroactive. They do that from time to time. They have the First Step Act illustrates exactly how to do that. Under your position, that's all irrelevant.
I don't think it's irrelevant, Your Honor. And I think McCoy addresses this directly, which is, in those situations, Congress takes a whole category and says, you can go back to court for this reason. In 3582, Congress created what McCoy calls a safety valve, so that in individual circumstances, sometimes those same factors and sometimes other factors and sometimes those factors combined, a court can say, yes, in this situation, that sentencing change with or without these other considerations is an extraordinary and compelling reason. And so following McCoy and Brooker and the majority of district courts that have all held the same thing, we'd ask the court to vacate and remand for the court to reconsider Mr. McKinney's motion.
All right, we thank you both for your argument and we'll consider the case carefully.